Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, along with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic, a pretty big problem on the 101 southbound in the East Valley. A crash at Baseline has the left lanes blocked, and it looks as though the delay is back to about the 202 or so. Valley forecast for the rest of the afternoon, calling for a slight chance of thunderstorms and a high of 91 degrees. Chance of rain continues into tonight, overnight lows near 70, sunny tomorrow and a high of 90. It's 88 degrees right now at KJZZ. With just about 2 weeks to go until the general election, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey says he trusts the state's election results will be accurate. KJZZ's Carrie Young reports.
Despite suggestions by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump that the election results might be rigged, Governor Ducey says he'll stand behind the numbers Arizona officials report. When asked if he still supports Trump in light of recent videos that show the candidate making lewd comments about women, Ducey says nothing has changed about his endorsement.
I am in favor of someone who will turn Washington, D.C. upside down. If there's one thing I think every American is in agreement with, is that our federal government does not work. And that's what I want to see happen through this election.
Earlier this month, Governor Ducey did publicly condemn Donald Trump's comments, calling them, quote, insulting and terribly demeaning to women. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Opponents of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio organized what they say is the biggest canvass in history against the sheriff over the weekend. It was organized by a group calling itself Basta Arpaio. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block covered this weekend's events and joins me now. Jude, what does Basta Arpaio mean and what were their aims?
So Basta means enough in Spanish, and they spell it B-A-Z-T-A, which is a play on the A-Z abbreviation for Arizona. So it's a way of saying we've had enough of Arpaio. And so over the weekend, you know, this campaign has been on the ground here knocking on doors for several weeks now, but they invited activists from all over the country to join them, and about 500 people altogether were knocking on doors. Those people came from New Mexico, California, as far as Georgia, Kentucky. So really an interesting big group of people.
So what's the goal? I mean, obviously the ultimate goal is enough Arpaio. I understand that, but as far as how many people they were trying to reach, how many registered voters, that sort of thing.
So the Basta Arpaio campaign has a goal of reaching 100,000 voters this campaign season. They're basically going after low propensity voters who they think, based on demographics, are likely to vote against Arpaio, but might need that extra nudge to encourage them to actually go out and vote. These are folks who have been registered before, but might not vote every cycle. So the idea is to just kind of remind people. This time over the weekend, they were reminding people with early ballots specifically to get those ballots in. When I was walking around in Chandler with some of these canvassers, we were finding a lot of people had said they'd actually already mailed in their ballot.
Now, Sheriff Arpaio is well known among the community. Governor Jan Brewer, of course, the person who signed SB 1070, made some more comments recently about she's not sure that Arizona could flip to Hillary Clinton because, as she says, Latinos don't vote. What was her response to that?
Right. That was on everyone's mind this weekend. There were a lot of snickers, really, about Jan Brewer's quote and people saying, you know what, we're going to show her. We're going to show her just how wrong she is because this year Latinos in Arizona will vote. So there's definitely, people staking that claim and, you know, we'll see what happens on November 8th for sure.
Jude, you've been covering the sheriff for a long time. You've also been covering this election season up close and personal. How does this particular effort, which you covered this weekend, compare to what you've seen, whether the Democratic Party or other communities around Arizona? Does this seem like there's a building of momentum? Does it seem like, in some ways, kind of more of the same?
It does feel like there's more momentum and energy on the Democratic side of things than I've seen in the past. Actually, when I was out in Chandler walking around with Basta Arpaio canvassers on the same block, they ran into Democratic canvassers who were canvassing for Paul Pinzon for sheriff, as well as other Democratic, like local, state, and representative candidates. So I, you know, that was really interesting, and we didn't see anyone from the other side. So there they were colliding on that block and saying, you know, we're gonna take back this neighborhood for make it go blue. So there was a, you know, that really kind of was an interesting moment to observe. But we should remember that, you know, the immigrants and activists did try to organize against Arpaio 4 years ago. There was the Adios Arpaio campaign with the help of labor unions. Ultimately, they didn't succeed that time. So we have seen grassroots pressure before, but we're also seeing polling this time that suggests that you know, Arpaio is behind in some of the polls we've seen.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thank you as always.
Thank you.
The VA hospital scandal that has gripped facilities across the nation was first made public in reporting by Dennis Wagner of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. The troubles included, but were not limited to, extended wait times for patients that in some cases led to deaths. Wagner has taken on a new project, traveling to VA hospitals in several cities across the nation to find out what's going well, what isn't, and whether anything has changed. And that reporting is currently featured on AZ Central. Dennis, one of the most striking scenes of part one of your new series took place at VA headquarters in Washington, D.C. What were your expectations for that meeting, and then what did you actually learn?
Yeah, I asked probably 25, 35 email questions, and I had, first of all, I had asked them to respond to me to those questions before I actually had the meeting, because I wanted to be able to follow up on whatever their responses were.
Yeah.
Well, I got no responses. I even asked for things like, could you point out some really good veterans hospitals? Because I'm going to be visiting veterans hospitals. Would you point some out to me so that I can go visit them? And I got nothing on that. And I asked for it at the meeting and got nothing on that. So we did a lot of talking about metrics and wait times and how difficult it is to measure and how the wait time metrics don't really work. And it was really, there was quite a bit of bureaucratic jargon going on.
Some people told you that, well, the wait times have gotten a lot better. They're more in the line of 4 to 7 days or something like that. Whereas other people will say the numbers are 10 times that and that the wait times haven't gotten any better. Did you determine you could trust anybody with these numbers? What was accurate?
I don't know the answer. I've worked on this story for 3 years. I have seen, I think there has been a substantial improvement at many VA hospitals with wait times. But I don't trust the numbers that are given me, and partly I don't trust them because the Government Accountability Office and the Inspector General's has said you cannot trust these numbers. So I honestly don't know how long veterans are waiting on average or median time or anything like that. And it's going to also vary depending on whether they're trying to see a primary care physician or a specialist, and it's going to depend on which hospital. And I think the one thing I can say with some certainty is, in the VA, everything depends on which hospital you're at and oftentimes which provider you're going to.
Can Congress do anything about this?
What members of Congress and their staffs have told me over and over again is we have a terrible quandary here because we're members of Congress. And the way members of Congress leverage any government agency is by saying, you don't behave, we're going to cut your funding. They cannot cut funding for veterans. That's just a no-win proposition for any member of Congress. So what they tell me over and over again is we try to beat them to death with shame. We try to embarrass them into doing the right thing.
How many different hospitals and facilities did you go to write these stories?
I went to 7 different hospitals, and I went to a number of other clinics as well, but I just counted the hospitals in terms of how we were addressing that. What I tried to do was get a cross-section, you know, geographically in the United States, and I also picked some because I knew there were certain issues, like I went to the Denver hospital because they have a hospital there that is just grotesquely over budget that they're trying to build, and they have been trying to build it for years. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, the hospital that's functioning there in Denver is functioning in a horrible situation.
So Dennis, what have you heard from people you've spoken with about, let's say, a satisfaction survey? Because you'll hear from different places that some veterans have said, well, I had fantastic care, and others will say they didn't. As you mentioned, there is a dynamic there where are you getting the care, who's giving it to you, et cetera. But what about that dichotomy there, the fact that there is such a difference? Does that give promise to some of the people you've spoken to that maybe things can get fixed because there are places doing it right?
I interviewed veterans at every hospital I went to. Mm-hmm. I would stand, they wouldn't let me be in the parking lot. One place they wouldn't even let me be on the sidewalk outside away from the hospital. But I found ways to interview veterans even if I had to go to a VFW bar. And I interviewed them, and it's just a fascinating experience because you will speak to one veteran who will tell you that they had to wait months for appointments and they got horrible care and they were mistreated and disrespected. Mm-hmm. And the next veteran will tell you the exact opposite, that this is the greatest place. They saved my life. They're the nicest people. And what you come away from it with is the sense that anecdotal evidence doesn't tell you a heck of a lot.
Has there been concern expressed that as we have more and more veterans come home, that fixing this problem has to be a priority even faster, and there has to be even more efficiency? Or is it just, well, we're doing the best we can?
There's a sense of urgency. When you talk to the VA officials, they'll tell you, we've got to get this right. When you talk to members of Congress, they'll say the same thing. But then there's the analogy to the giant ship in the ocean, and you just can't turn it fast. And this ship was, by most accounts, very far off course, heading into a hurricane, and they're trying to turn it, but quick fixes are not going to work.
Dennis Wagner of the Arizona Republic, AZ Central, and Gannett. We've been talking about his latest series about the VA and efforts at improving. Dennis, thanks.
You betcha.
A group of immigrants from Haiti fleeing poverty in South America is currently waiting to enter the U.S. across the border in Nogales, Sonora, Mexico. As Michel Morisco reports from KJZZ's Fronteras desk, these Haitians are just a small number of thousands that have been arriving at the U.S.-Mexico line, but their journey is far from over.
A little less than a week ago, Davidson Pechulte and his companions arrived at the downtown Nogales, Mexico port of entry. They set their scarce belongings against a wall out of the way of the long line of mostly Mexicans crossing into the U.S. and sat down to await their chance to ask to cross in. It's been a long hopscotch journey, best described this way.
Brazil, yo pasame de Argentina, y Chile, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Panamá, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, y aquí en México.
Pechulte and his 70 other Haitians, all young men, started this 12-country journey in exodus from Haiti 6 years ago after the massive 2010 earthquake killed at least 100,000 people. They fled to Brazil to work.
Nothing is easy in this world. I must work, man, to get the money.
That's James Claudet, who fled to Brazil from the capital, Port au Prince, that year.
$6, $7, 4 days to work in everybody. It's not good. And hey, no, on days, $7.
Those $7 a day he was earning left him hungry for a better life. And that, he says, is why he traveled an estimated 10,000 miles to sit against the white tiled walls of Nogales' port of entry, less than 10 feet from the United States. It was mostly uneventful, he says. The groups traveled by bus and walked, except for
Panama. Panama is the bad country. It's the bad country.
He was harassed, he says, forced, accosted by police, stole from him.
How's Mexico?
Mexico is a boot. Mexico didn't be good, very good Mexico. But it's okay. It's okay for this moment. For this moment, it's okay. I don't know, but tomorrow, I don't know.
Ultimately, Claude and many of his companions want to travel to Florida. His sister lives in Orlando. But first, they must cross through the metal turnstile leading into the U.S. port of entry. And right now, Customs and Border Protection is only taking a few of these newcomers in for interviews every day. And it's a growing issue at the U.S.'s southern border.
The Haitian migrants, they had been arriving in Tijuana and in Mexicali, but just started arriving here this past Wednesday.
Father Sean Carroll runs a migrant shelter in Nogales, Mexico, called the Kino Border Initiative. On this afternoon, he's preparing a mass on the Arizona side of the border, yards from the waiting Haitians.
we are. We've been helping to bring them food, but what's been wonderful is to see how the local community of Nogales, Sonora, has been organizing itself to bring food to the Haitian migrants waiting there at the downtown port of entry.
And Customs and Border Protection officials declined to be interviewed, but shared that the U.S.'s immigration policies for Haiti have ebbed and flowed as the country faced a sequence of natural disasters. Immigration officials are taking each one on a case-by-case basis. How many of these young men will be deported remains to be seen. 2 years ago, the U.S. extended a temporary protected status for Haitian refugees fleeing the ravages of the 2010 quake. That extension ended just last September, meaning these young men here in Nogales missed the deadline by 4 weeks. Some could still seek asylum under threats of persecution, but the legitimacy of that claim is determined by an interviewing immigration officer. In the meantime, the U.S. promised to speed up deportations of Haitian immigrants in the country illegally. And then Hurricane Matthew hit. So the U.S. again reversed course, suspending its deportation flights to Haiti, all of which means men like Claude and those who are with him could wait in a detention center in limbo until they are either deported or convince a CBP officer that it's too dangerous to return home. Reporting from Nogales, Sonora, Michel Marisco, KJZZ News.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. The AT&T-Time Warner merger would potentially be the biggest of its kind in history, creating one of the most powerful media companies in the world.
It would give AT&T control of entire swaths of the entertainment genre, everything from HBO's catalog to cable news with CNN to professional basketball on TNT and the Batman and DC superhero movies owned by Warner Brothers.
When people watch CNN, are they getting an independent assessment and reporting of the news? The last thing we want to do as AT&T is in any way taint that in the slightest bit.
Randall Stephenson, chairman and CEO of AT&T, suggesting that control doesn't mean control as he talks about this merger. Jason Abruzzese is business section editor for Mashable. Jason, thanks for helping us out here.
Appreciate it.
Biggest media company in the world. What does that mean anymore?
It's going to be mean scale. It means how many people can you touch and then how much stuff can you make? That's really the end all and be all. There's nothing else to it.
Time Warner is this giant island of stuff, and AT&T is this desperate island of just phones. Yeah. And they've got to go somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, phones, there's a little bit of internet, there's a little bit of cable TV, but yeah, it's just a distribution company. It specializes in getting stuff from one place to another. It doesn't do much beyond that.
But the FCC, which approved NBC Comcast, why would they look at this askance?
I mean, I think a lot of people look back at the NBC Comcast deal and wish it didn't go through. And we've been interesting to see how the discussion around these mergers has changed since then. People have grown very, very skeptical of these companies pairing together, what it means for consumers, what it means for other companies in the space trying to be competitive. They don't want, these kind of mega companies to squeeze out every kind of middle tier, lower tier company. That's not good for consumers. It's not good for the economy.
What does this mean for on-demand? If AT&T pulls this off, can they set prices for virtually all on-demand stuff that's owned by Time Warner?
I wouldn't go that far, and they're going to be very, very cautious to do that, because if they start doing that, they're going to make a lot of people very angry. And making a lot of people very angry in this kind of deal is the last thing they want to do. So I think they're going to be very, very cautious. They're going to tiptoe into that. We might see some certain deals, but I would be surprised if we saw anything major on the consumer side.
It used to be the only thing that consumers cared about was their cable bill. Now it's the on-demand price point plus the cable bill, mm-hmm. plus their phone bill and whatever data charges they get depending on how much content they view on their mobile devices.
Yeah.
How does AT&T Time Warner get control of that, or is it still going to be a consumer chaos?
What AT&T sees is, like, we're trying to sell all those services, and you summed it up perfectly. There's no more, we're just selling TV, we're just selling cable, we're just selling wireless. They're selling everything. They're trying to sell all of that to as many people as possible. One of the ways you can make your package more appealing, aside from price, is to say, we got a few extras, maybe a little bit of better content, maybe a few more exclusives. Maybe you can get Game of Thrones on your phone a little easier. There's certain perks they can do when they link up these companies, and that's where we might start to see an effect on the consumer side, where AT&T starts using things like zero rating, not to get too wonky, but this is the big thing in the wireless sector now, which is basically you have your wireless plan, you're trying not to use too much data, so the company says, well, you can go ahead and stream Game of Thrones for free if you're on AT&T. ooh, all of a sudden AT&T seems a lot more appealing. I'll go buy the AT&T plan.
But that seems like a transitional moment. Ultimately, the consumer is going to go, hey, this is great if somebody can figure out how to bundle the entire package into a single login on all your devices, and basically you get everything without having to do any sort of passwords, any sort of with just one company. Is anybody capable of doing that yet?
AT&T is probably closest at this point because they do have the whole range. Comcast is working to get there. There have been reports, I think confirmed now publicly, that they're going to try to launch a wireless network. So you're going to be able to get Comcast for your phone like you do AT&T and T-Mobile. Comcast are obviously already a huge cable and broadband distributor. So they're absolutely racing to get to that endpoint where they can offer you that one complete package at a, you know, maybe a slight markup, but you know, the convenience, the bundling, those are the kind of things that consumers have already shown that they want and that they'll pay a little bit more for.
So suddenly the pipeline doesn't matter. It's the brand of the company that owns all the pipelines simultaneously and can sell the service simultaneously. Is that the way it's going?
Yeah, I mean, it's the pipeline's the one and the same here. I mean, they're basically all trying to throw these services together because they realize somebody who's watching something on TV is probably going to at some point try to watch it on their phone, is probably at some point going to try to watch it on their computer, and you kind of want to be everywhere and at all those touch points. And if you can offer that service and make it really usable and convenient, that's something that, you know, people want and that people are going to maybe pay a little bit more for. And if you get there first and you have some content to back it up, that's a very, very persuasive kind of, you know, bundle for consumers.
The FCC shuts this down. How bad is that for AT&T? Because Verizon is now got a head up.
It's bad if this doesn't go through. They're going to face billions of dollars in break fees. I think the Wall Street Journal actually had a report come out last night showing that if the FCC strikes it down, I think it's at least $1 billion they have to pay to Time Warner. If somebody actually comes in and overbids, they're going to owe money too here. So this is a risky proposition. This is no safe bet. This is a bold move, but something that AT&T probably had to do. They couldn't not do anything.
Jason Abruzzese is business section editor for Mashable. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
U.S. members of the military who have served in places like Iraq and Afghanistan bring back deep experiences, many of which are traumatic. But Joseph Stenger, who's a fighter pilot currently stationed at Luke Air Force Base in the Valley, returned home with the desire to provide increased economic opportunities for Afghan widows. He and three co-founders developed flying scarves as a form of microeconomic development. The scarves are handmade in Afghanistan and sold all over the world through the organization. And Joseph Stenger's here to tell us more about it. Joseph, how did what you and your fellow veterans saw in Afghanistan make you want to start this nonprofit?
So our company was founded on the belief that you can suffocate an insurgency by empowering women and creating microeconomic opportunity for them. And so, like you said, we were deployed to Afghanistan in 2011, and we weren't there for long before we started to question what the underpinnings of the insurgency actually were, what caused people to join, like what circumstances led to that. So we decided to engage the locals. And through those discussions, we found out that while there were certainly people joining the insurgency for religious purposes or because of anger towards the United States or something else, there was a large portion of young men and boys who were joining out of sheer desperation. So these young men, many of whom might be only 9 or 10 years old, were often the sons of widows. And so what's unique about Afghanistan and a culture like Afghanistan is that women in that culture cannot really go or travel much without a male escort. And so that limits the options of widows working in that country. They can only stay in their homes. They're drastically limited by their ability to move. And so what that means is their children are often forced onto the streets of Kabul to beg. And that creates a form of desperation that's very powerful.
So how do you establish the trust with the people in that community, some of whom are happy to see you, but many who are not?
So on Bagram, there are thousands of Afghan natives working there, doing a variety of jobs. And surprisingly, many of them are very friendly towards the troops that are actually there. And that actually caught me a little bit off guard, too. I wasn't expecting that. And that was part of, I think, my own maturation while I was deployed there, was actually realizing that maybe some of the beliefs that I've been, that we've been told aren't necessarily true. They're people just like you and I, and they wanted to have those discussions with us. They wanted to talk about, the issues that their country has. And through those discussions, that's how we found out about, you know, the paradigm of where children have to go into the streets of Kabul and beg.
And where did the initial idea for flying scarves come from?
There was a bazaar on base that we actually went to, and through maybe serendipity, saw a young man there, and his mother just so happened to be going out into the community and finding women there and teaching them how to sew. And then she would go around door to door and collect those scarves that they sewed and bring them onto base to sell to us or in their own community. And so when we learned their story, it fit perfectly into what we were trying to accomplish there. So after we were in business for a few years, we were approached by a group of women who were working in an orphanage in Kenya. And they actually were looking for us to take our business model and incorporate it into what they were working with HIV-infected widows in Kenya. And what was really cool, what came out of that is they took the money that they were making from the sale of handbags that we were selling at the time. And they actually, a few of them started their own businesses that turned out to be quite successful. And that's exactly what we want to do is, you know, we don't want to be the end-all be-all for these women. We want them to go a step beyond us. That's the ultimate goal.
What sort of guts does it take even for women to want to say, I want to go in business with these guys?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to emphasize the fact that we get a lot of credit for flying scarves, but we are certainly not the heroes of this story. We are nothing more than facilitators. The women that we work with, they're the heroes for all the reasons you just mentioned. They push the limits of social propriety every single day. And in some cases, they even risk their lives so that they can make enough money to send their children to school. They want their children to be educated so that they can build a better future for Afghanistan. They realize the impact that education can have. When they buy a scarf from us, that's ultimately what you're investing in. You get, obviously, a beautiful scarf that's handmade in Afghanistan, which is pretty cool. But you're also making an investment in that woman's grit and in her belief in herself and in her belief in her children, the future of her country.
Joseph Stenger, he's co-founder and CEO of Flying Scarves.
And now for a little bit of pop culture nostalgia. 20 years ago, Tom Hanks made his directorial debut in a movie about the successes and struggles of a band that, against all odds, miraculously makes it big. Not only does the movie feature one of the most well-known earworms of the mid-90s, but also a radio station called KJZZ. Sarah Ventry tells us exactly what is that thing.
That Thing You Do, starring Tom Everett Scott, Liv Tyler, and Tom Hanks, follows a band called The Wonders from Erie, Pennsylvania in 1964, who managed to strike it big, literally becoming one-hit wonders.
That Thing You Do is the fastest rising single in the history of the Playtone label. As of tomorrow morning, you wonders, you've got the number 7 record in the country.
As the band rises to stardom, the members head west to L.A. There, they cut a record, star in a major motion picture, and go on a press tour of Southern California radio stations to promote their new record. One of the stops? A little jazz station called KJZZ. It's run out of a green bungalow house with a palm tree in the yard. And the DJ is played by Clint Howard, Ron Howard's brother.
Let me ask you cats this question. Who are your influences?
A somewhat significant plot point. The Wonders' dreamy drummer, Guy Patterson, is a huge jazz fan.
Stan Getz, anything he did on the Verve label. Bill Evans Trio, Ira Sullivan, Kenny Dorham, John Young, Del Paxton. Yeah.
The movie is kind of a tribute to 1960s rock, but it also ends up being sort of a testimonial for the transformative power of jazz music.
That's Joe Blevins, contributor to The Onion's non-satirical pop culture site, The AV Club. In the movie, fictitious drummer Guy Patterson winds up meeting his jazz hero, pianist Del Paxton. Paxton actually makes a cameo in the movie. The two play together, and it changes Patterson. Here's Blevins.
Jazz music in the movie is shown to be more spiritually satisfying or intellectually satisfying or musically satisfying than playing this sort of bubblegum rock and roll. It's like the one true path for him was jazz.
It's true. At the end of the movie, we're led to believe that Guy Patterson stays in Southern California to pursue a career as a jazz drummer. We like to think he would have been an avid listener of our KJZZ, but in the meantime, we'll keep doing that thing we do. And if I know you, you're doing that thing. Sarah Ventry, The Real KJZZ News, Phoenix.
People who believe in ghosts, and there are some people who don't.
God, it knows I'm here.
Are you a ghost too?
There are no such things as ghosts.
Ghosts.
Goats?
Call them what you like. Ghosts, spirits, haunts, phantoms. October is the time to share their stories. There are the classic scary stories we share over the campfire, and the surreal stories we share about our own encounters. Today, John De Los Santos. He's an out-of-state opera librettist who wrote an opera about an infamous ghost at a hotel in Bisbee. He and a friend decided to take a road trip and check into the haunted hotel room themselves.
This whole thing began when my collaborator, Clint Borzoni, who is a composer, came to me and said there's a competition for a new opera in Arizona, and we have 2 days to submit. Do you have any ideas? And I said, well, give me 2 days and I'll figure something out. And I literally Googled weird things in Arizona, and after about 5 pages of UFOs, because I mean, who wants to see E.T. the opera, I found the Copper Queen Hotel in Bisbee, which is haunted by 3 ghosts, the most prominent and famous of which is Julia Lowell, who was a prostitute who lived there about 100 years ago and killed herself in her room over the loss of her favorite client, who she became in love with. And she, to this day, still haunts the room. Piecing it together was difficult because there's not a lot of information about her. There's really just the legend about this woman. There's no documentation. There's all different stories about her. And there's a ghost log that you can purchase from the hotel where people have actually written their experiences in the hotel. And so I kind of took the legend, and then the opera is structured in 10 scenes where it goes between 2010, where a modern woman named Addison goes and stays in the room, and then flashes back to 1910 for Julia's time. And so you basically experience the last couple of months of Julia's life with this contemporary woman who experiences these visions of what happened to her before she died.
10 years back in Bisbee Town, chip away the debt.
We actually were close to finishing the piece, and I said to Clint, we need to go. We need to just go. And he was like, oh, no, I think it's fine. I was like, no, we're going. So I booked the hotel myself, and that room, 315, is very difficult to reserve. And so we were really lucky to get to stay there. And I called him, and I said, all right, we're going to go a day early, and we're going to drive to Bisbee and stay in the room, so pack your bags.
Here she is.
Number 315. Wow, look at this wallpaper. The picture's in your brochure.
And we went into the room, and it was exactly the way we had envisioned it and thought about it. And we didn't know it at the time, but we were in for a pretty scary night. Before we went to bed, we played her the main aria, the main solo that Julia sings called Still Pretty. And, you know, we just sat there and played through the whole thing, and it was very, very goosebump-inducing, definitely, but nothing happened at that point. One of the most common things about Julia's room is if you sleep in her bed, she tickles your feet or pulls the covers off or even gets into bed with you, all kinds of things. And I said, all right, the bed's yours. I'm going to just sleep on the floor with, you know, some pillows and blankets and everything, and we'll see what happens. So at about 4 a.m, I woke up and I felt the most unbelievable rage, and I just wanted to break something. And it was weird. It was like this very strange kind of night terror or something, which I've never experienced in my entire life.
Julia.
So Clint woke up with this look on his face, and he said he had dreamt, not once, but twice, that someone had been pulling on his legs. And also, he was wearing, like, pajama bottoms and socks, and he said his feet the entire night were freezing. We didn't see Julia, we didn't smell or necessarily hear anything, but we definitely walked away with feeling like we had been touched or at least influenced by something, and all of that has made its way into the show. We didn't know going into what was going to happen, but obviously experiencing that not only enriched the show, but Clint and I drove out of there saying, my God, here we are, two boys from across the country coming here, just working on a piece of art, but experiencing something that we'll never, ever, ever forget. Julia will always stay with me after going in that room, and I hope that the opera will achieve that for people too.
That was John De Los Santos, who wrote the opera The Copper Queen, inspired by the Bisbee Hotel of the same name. Music for the opera was composed by Clint Borzoni. Stay tuned for another story that's sure to raise your spirits next Monday on the show.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.